We'll provide an overview of the basic tax and accounting issues to be addressed in a merger or acquisition. However, it will be limited to a summary, because the tax laws are very complex and are constantly changing. You should discuss the accounting issues with a certified public accountant, CPA, who will serve as part of the acquisition team. Mergers and acquisitions may be completely tax-free, partially tax-free, or entirely taxable to the seller. Keep in mind that some types of transactions are taxable or tax-free. Each party and its advisors will have its own, often differing, views on how the transaction should be structured from a tax perspective, depending on the non-tax strategic objectives of both buyer and seller in the transaction, and the respective tax and financial position of each party. In some cases, the tax consequences will be the primary driving force in the transaction, whereas in other cases, the tax consequences are secondary or even a non-issue. In addition to the taxable aspects of the structure of the transaction, there will be a wide variety of other tax issues to be considered, such as the tax basis of the assets acquired, the impact of the imputed interest rules on the transaction, and the tax aspects of any deferred consideration and/or incentive compensation to the seller. Taxable versus non-taxable deals. Taxable. Purchase of stock for cash, promissory notes, or other non-equity consideration. Purchase of assets for cash, promissory notes, or other non-equity consideration. Taxable transactions generally anticipate that the seller will have little or no continuing equity participation in the acquired company. Non-taxable. An exchange of the buyer's stock for the seller's stock. An exchange of the buyer's stock for all or substantially all of the seller's assets. Non-taxable transactions generally anticipate a continuing, direct or indirect equity participation in the acquired company by the seller or its shareholders. It is relevant to highlight an example that illustrates the degree to which tax considerations can be an impediment to a transaction. In one situation, the CEO of the seller had negotiated a carve-out with his board and received some of the new combined company's stock as personal income. That income, however, created more than $1 million in cash tax liability. This tax liability presented a significant challenge to getting the deal done. The CEO, who deserved credit for the deal, now had a strong incentive to prevent the deal from happening. Navigating tax liability issues, like the one in this example, is a critical step in successful deal closure. The general tax-related goals of the seller usually include deferring the taxation of the gain realized on the sale of the business to a future date. For example, if the seller acquires the buyer's securities and these appreciate in value, the seller generally need not pay taxes on these gains until these securities are sold. Classifying the income that is recognized as capital gain and not as ordinary income. Ensuring that cash is available to pay taxes as they become due, and to avoid the double tax, taxation at both the corporate and the shareholder level. Again, the strategic objectives must be balanced against the tax consequences. If the seller has an immediate need for liquidity or has no desire to receive the buyer's securities, the seller may not accept the buyer's post-closing vision and plans for the combined entities, then it will be difficult to achieve non-taxable status. Over the years, changes in the federal tax laws have chipped away at the buyer's motivations for having the transaction characterized as tax-free. The buyer's ability to carry over favorable tax attributes of the seller has been diminished to such a degree that the buyer's use of its own securities as consideration to pay the seller often has more to do with preservation of cash than it does with the applicable tax laws. If the transaction is taxable, then the tax basis will be stepped up or increased to equal the fair market value of the consideration paid to the seller. If the transaction is non-taxable, the buyer is able to carry over the seller's tax basis to its own financial statements. If the buyer would prefer to carry these assets on the balance sheet at the stepped-up tax basis, for example, if the buyer is paying much more than the seller's tax basis, or if the buyer would prefer not to issue securities to the seller to prevent dilution of ownership, then the buyer should opt for a taxable transaction. Based on our experience, resolving the tax issues between the parties effectively is critically important. This issue has a direct impact on the price of the transaction and each party's perception of the fair value. Most corporate acquisitions will be deemed to be taxable transactions if they are structured as a purchase of either stock or assets in exchange for cash, promissory notes, or other forms of non-equity consideration. Non-taxable transactions usually fall more into the category of a merger in that they involve an exchange of the target company's stock or assets for the purchaser's equity securities or those of a subsidiary created by the purchaser, coupled with some direct or indirect continuing relationship between the buyer and the seller and their respective shareholders. These non-taxable transactions must fall within one of several reorganization categories contained in IRS Code Section 368. Tax-free reorganizations. If the parties choose to structure the transaction as a tax-free reorganization, then the requirements set forth here must be followed. The three principal forms of tax-free reorganizations under the Internal Revenue Code are 1. Type A statutory merger, 2. Type B stock-for-stock merger, and 3. Type C stock-for-assets merger. 1. Type A reorganizations. A Type A reorganization is a statutory merger or consolidation under state law. No express limitations are imposed on the type of consideration that can be used in the transaction or on the disposition of assets prior to the merger. This is a very flexible acquisition device that permits shareholders to receive property, including cash, in addition to stock of the acquiring corporation. 2. Type B reorganizations. A Type B reorganization is an acquisition of one corporation by another in exchange solely for all or part of its voting stock or that of its controlling company. Immediately after the acquisition, the acquiring corporation must have control, at least 80% of the total combined voting power of all classes of stock, and at least 80% of the total number of shares of all other classes of stock, of such other corporation, whether or not the acquiring corporation had control immediately before the acquisition. Counsel to the buyer, however, must be particularly sensitive to any cash payment, such as a finder's fee or the payment of appraisal rights to dissenting shareholders. 3. Type C reorganizations. A Type C reorganization is an acquisition of one corporation by another in exchange solely for all or part of its voting stock or that of its parent and substantially all of the properties of that corporation. The transferor corporation must distribute the stock, securities, and other properties it receives from the acquiring corporation, as well as any retained assets, as part of the plan of reorganization. The tax aspects of the proposed transaction are among the most important issues to be addressed by the acquisition team. These laws are complex and are constantly changing. Therefore, knowledgeable advisors should be carefully consulted. Accounting issues. The pooling of interests method of merger accounting ended on June 30, 2001, almost without fanfare. Before that time, companies, especially financial firms and those in the high technology and pharmaceutical industries, often chose pooling as a way of avoiding the long-term earnings dilution caused by the amortization of goodwill against earnings. Goodwill was defined as the excess of the cost of an acquired entity over the net of the amounts calculated for assets acquired and liabilities assumed. The objections to the elimination of pooling have been muted to a large degree because of the new rules for treating acquired goodwill and intangibles in a purchase acquisition. Instead of the old approach of amortization of goodwill over a period of up to 40 years, companies now must subject the acquired goodwill to a complex annual impairment test aimed at determining whether there has been a decline in the value of that goodwill. Write-offs are required only if the value has been impaired. The impact will be initially positive because amortization of the goodwill is no longer automatically required. The Financial Accounting Standards Board's FASB approach, adopted in Statement 142, Goodwill and Other Intangible Assets, in July 2001, is more complicated than amortization. Under these FASB Goodwill and Intangible Asset Measurement Standards, companies generally must perform an impairment test yearly for each reporting unit. This is a two-step test that first determines whether the book value of the acquired assets of the reporting unit exceeds the unit's so-called fair value, typically measured through discounted cash flow estimates. If fair value is lower than book value, the company then must determine whether the fair value of the unit's goodwill is less than the goodwill's book value, which would necessitate an impairment loss being recognized. Since companies do not know in what year goodwill may become impaired, financial personnel may be challenged to predict earnings internally to a greater degree. Further tension concerning the FASB's new criteria for determining whether some acquired intangible assets, like patents, should be recognized separately from goodwill and perhaps amortized over the asset's perceived lifespan is created as a result of the new rules. Although there are dozens of ways to structure a transaction, the core five structures are described later. One-step versus staged transactions. Another key issue regarding the structure of the deal is whether the entire transaction will be completed in one step or whether it will occur over a series of steps. The parties may want to get to know each other better before considering a full-blown merger, or there may be some contingencies affecting the value of the company that are driving the buyer, or even the seller, to want to slow things down and consider a preliminary transaction as the first step. It is also plausible that the seller believes that the long-term value of the company may be much higher, and as a result would prefer to keep some of his chips still on the table. For example, from the buyer's perspective, there may be certain government approvals needed that affect the seller's valuation, such as the approval of the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, for a new line of pharmaceutical or medical devices. These approvals may be 2 years away, and if they are not obtained, would significantly affect the value of the seller's business. In such a case, the buyer may want to consider an alternative and more preliminary initial structure, such as a strategic alliance as a first step toward a merger, or a technology licensing agreement as a first step toward an acquisition. There may even be certain shares exchanged to allow cross-ownership, or the buyer may want to purchase a minority interest in the seller with an option to purchase the balance within 6 months after obtaining FDA approval. Alternatively, the seller may have certain reservations about the buyer, or may want to see certain contingencies met before it commits to selling 100% of its business. The buyer may be waiting for some key third-party approval or event to take place, before which the seller may be reluctant to commit, such as the buyer's being in the process of filing for approval of an initial public offering, IPO, of its securities. If these securities are to serve as part of the seller's compensation, then it may be wise to wait to ensure that there will be a secondary market, and hence liquidity, for the shares before moving forward. In such cases, the parties would enter into a letter of intent, but there would typically be a clause that allows the seller to walk away from the deal if the offering is unsuccessful. Some transactions are multi-staged for strategic reasons, and some may be structured to be one stage with the possibility of being multi-staged if certain post-closing contingencies are not met. The five basic structural alternatives. 1. Asset purchase. This is often the simplest of structures, with the buyer purchasing a set of selected assets from the seller in exchange for cash or other assets. 2. Stock purchase. The shareholders of the seller sell their shares to the buyer in exchange for cash or other assets. 3. Statutory merger. The statutory merger is a non-taxable acquisition in which one corporation completely absorbs another by virtue of a merger under state corporate law. 4. Stock-for-stock acquisition. The acquiring company exchanges its voting stock for the stock of the acquiring company. 5. Stock-for-assets acquisition. This is generally a non-taxable transaction where the acquiring company exchanges only its voting stock, or that of its parent, for substantially all of the assets of the target corporation. Method of payment. The way in which the seller will be paid is quite clearly one of the most important aspects of structuring the deal. The method of payment for the acquisition of stock or assets ordinarily involves a balancing of business and tax considerations. Often a particular fact or set of circumstances will outweigh the others and determine the method of payment. Although the personal, strategic, and tax needs of all parties must be considered, there is a wide variety of forms of payment that should be considered before a final decision is made. These include cash, marketable securities, parcels of real estate, the rights to intangible assets, licenses, franchises, and so on, secured and unsecured promissory notes, the common and preferred securities of the purchaser or its affiliates, often with the promise that these securities will one day be publicly traded, earnouts, consulting and employment agreements, royalty and license agreements, or even the exchange of another business. All of these tools should be considered in structuring the elements of the purchase price. For example, a seller who is concerned about the financial and/or business viability or the creditworthiness of a buyer will demand payment in cash for the assets or stock being sold. Alternatively, a seller who is reluctant to dispose of an interest in a business completely or who wishes to defer taxes to a later taxable year may be willing to take the buyer's stock and/or take back a promissory note as part of the consideration. Tax considerations may also dictate the form of payment. From a buyer's perspective, debt is often preferable to stock, since interest may be tax-deductible. For example, in a leveraged acquisition, the business assets acquired are expected to generate sufficient cash flow to pay off the debt incurred to acquire the assets. Another key factor that has had a significant impact on the nature of deals and the method of payment is the state of the capital markets. For example, during the global financial crisis of late 2008, credit markets tightened significantly, and private equity firms developed cold feet over their investments, in particular, in capital-locking projects. The significant write-downs that financial institutions had to take as a result of the subprime mortgage crisis that followed the bursting of the housing bubble resulted in an evaporation of liquidity as such institutions tightened borrowing terms in order to guard their remaining capital, thus making debt financing difficult to secure. Things have improved from 2010 to 2017, but some conservatism in lending is still prevalent as bad memories from the financial meltdown remain. Thus, even though a leveraged acquisition might be ideal considering other factors, the crisis prevailing today is likely to force a plan B that is less ideal. Cash. It is often said that cash is king. This is particularly true in the current financial situation in the M&A sector. Although at first blush most sellers envision an all-cash deal as the preferred route, they must consider a wide variety of payment methods, some of which may result in a much greater total price in the long run. There are certain circumstances, however, when an all-cash transaction makes sense, such as when the seller suspects that the buyer will be unable to honor the types of consideration mentioned previously, as they may depend on the buyer's long-term viability and credibility. From a buyer's perspective, an all-cash transaction can be internally financed, financed by raising equity or in conjunction with a private equity fund, financed through the cash flow of the combined companies and/or the acquired company, or even financed through asset-based lending, to be collateralized by the business assets or stock acquired. Debt. If the creditworthiness of the buyer is high, then sellers may be willing to accept promissory notes from the buyer as part of the consideration. These promissory notes may be secured by the assets of the buyer, by the seller's assets, or not at all, or they may be guaranteed by the buyer's principals. It is also possible that the notes will be subordinated to a senior commercial lender if the buyer borrows money from a bank as part of its capital to acquire the seller's business. Stock. The securities of the buyer may constitute all or part of the payment to the seller for the business assets or stock. In some situations, common stock of the buyer or a newly formed subsidiary or even a new class of preferred stock, will be issued to encourage a seller to maintain an economic interest in the ongoing viability of the business assets or stock being sold. Under this type of payment structure, a seller can participate as a shareholder in any future growth in value or profits derived from the combined entities, and is thus motivated to ensure the success of the business. Convertible securities. Convertible debt securities often enable buyers and sellers to obtain the benefits of both the stock and the debt forms of payment. From a seller's perspective, convertible debt securities provide downside protection and a fixed return while offering the opportunity to reap the benefits of growth in value or profits derived from the combined entities. From a buyer's perspective, they provide the tax advantages of interest deductions while enabling the buyer to avoid payments of principal at maturity should such an instrument be converted into equity. Contingent payments. Often, buyers and sellers will be unable to agree on the determination of the value of the assets or stock being sold, or may want to reserve the right to adjust the terms of the transaction in light of changes in circumstances or expectations. Contingent consideration provides for additional payments based on factors such as revenue targets, cash flow goals, or synergies achieved. Similarly, the parties to an acquisition may provide for the repayment of cash or other consideration through the use of escrows or other security arrangements upon the occurrence of specified contingencies. Non-traditional structures and strategies. There are a wide variety of non-traditional deal structures and acquisition strategies that are not as straightforward as a stock or asset purchase, such as spin-offs, roll-ups, leveraged buyouts, and employee stock ownership plans. These deal structures are often a smaller slice of an overall corporate restructuring, but they nevertheless have grown and become a significant part of the annual merger and acquisition activity. However, as stated earlier, the recent downturn in financial markets has led to a decrease in the availability of the financing required for such non-traditional structures. For example, leveraged buyout activity has been reduced significantly as a result of the credit crunch. This has led to an overall marked decrease in M&A activity through such non-traditional sources. An introduction to spin-offs. Spin-offs are transactions that are designed to divest non-core operating divisions or assets, or divisions that have matured to the point of deserving or requiring standalone status, into their own independent operating company. Although some respectable companies have been created as a result of spin-offs, it has also been said, you don't spin off your crown jewels for no reason. Many spin-offs have been criticized by the IRS as trying to dump liabilities into spin-off entities, which then have balance sheets laden with debt and a core focus with limited potential. In 2008 through 2010, there was a significant uptick in public spin-offs and divestitures as companies scrambled to raise cash, cut costs, and streamline their operations by shedding certain business units and focusing on their core competencies. According to a 2008 study by Thomson Reuters, 49 spin-offs were accomplished by public companies in 2008, up from 31 in 2007, and 2009 set a record of over 60 spin-off transactions. From 2010 to 2016, spin-offs stabilized and leveled off a bit, but still featured notable transactions, such as the spin-off of the MGM Growth Properties LLC by MGM Resorts International. These transactions can be complex, and careful thought must be given to the viability of the spun-off entity after it leaves the mothership. Employee anxiety is likely to be high. Many will worry about job security, access to resources, corporate culture, and compensation. It is also critical to address the terms and conditions of any ongoing relationship between the spin-off entity and its previous parent, such as sharing of key technology, customers, or resources, as well as resolution of any conflicts of interest. Another trend is to spin off governance and decision-making without spinning off ownership, the not-quite-spin-off spin-off, as Caterpillar did in the fall of 2009 with several of its operating divisions. To qualify for favorable tax treatment, the transaction must meet the rigorous Internal Revenue Service business purpose test designed to ensure that a spin-off has a valid business reason. Among the purposes that are acceptable to the IRS are that a deal will help with access to capital markets, debt financing prospects, competitive position, management direction, or retention of key employees. Leveraged buyouts. A leveraged buyout, LBO, is a transaction in which capital borrowed from a commercial lender is used to fund a large portion of the purchase. Generally, the loans are arranged with the expectation that the earnings of the business will easily repay the principal and interest. The LBO potentially has great rewards for the buyers who, although they frequently make little or no investment, own the target company free and clear after the acquisition loans are repaid from the earnings of the business. LBOs are often arranged to enable the managers of subsidiaries or divisions of large corporations to purchase a subsidiary or division that the corporation wants to divest, a transaction known as an MBO, or management buyout. The LBO transaction will generally take one of two basic forms, the sale of assets or the cash merger. Under the cash merger format, the acquired company disappears through a merger into the acquiring company, and its shareholders receive cash for their shares. Under the sale of assets format, on the other hand, the operating assets become part of the buying company, but the selling company will generally be given the option of either receiving cash or continuing to hold its shares in the selling company. A variation of the LBO transaction is the use of paid-in-kind, PIK notes to finance LBOs. PIK notes allow borrowers to make interest payments with securities instead of cash. This structure allows the borrower to take out a loan and choose whether it wants to make interest payments as due or in aggregate at the end of the loan period at a higher fee. At the heart of the LBO transaction are the dynamics of financing the acquisition by employing the assets of the acquired company as a basis for raising capital. Large unused borrowing capacity is the characteristic that typically enables a purchaser to use the seller's assets to borrow the purchase price. Specific factors that may exist to enhance borrowing capacity are: 1. Large amounts of excess cash and cash equivalents, such as certificates of deposit and other short-term paper. 2. A limited amount of current debt. 3. A demonstrated ability to achieve substantial earnings over a number of years. 4. Substantial undervalued assets, which, when taken individually, have a market value in excess of the depreciated value at which they are carried on the seller's balance sheets, sometimes called hidden equity. 5. Subsidiaries with operations in unrelated industries that have large amounts of excess properties that can be readily liquidated for cash without detriment to ongoing operations. And 6. The potential for hidden cash flow for the purchaser arising from income sheltered by depreciable property, the basis of which is readjusted upward as a consequence of the sale. Because of the complexities and uncertainties associated with arranging financing of this nature, the purchase agreement should provide that the purchaser's obtaining the financing is a condition precedent to the purchaser's obligations under the agreement. Consolidations, roll-ups. Another major structural trend or strategy that became popular during the 1990s and has continued to be popular as of 2017 in select industries and market conditions is the consolidation or roll-up. Under such a strategy, the buyer is a holding company that has targeted an industry that may be ripe for consolidation within a given region or market niche. The roll-up strategy may be horizontal or vertical in nature, but it typically involves the aggressive acquisition of competitors in a given market to achieve operating efficiencies, synergies, and market dominance. Obviously, antitrust laws are an issue, see Chapter 7, and some acquisitions will be friendly and some hostile. The consideration paid to the seller is usually the securities of the buyer. It is best to devise a plan and a compensation strategy that provide an incentive for the current management to stay in place and build up the value of their equity in the consolidated entity. The roll-up buyer must look at each deal to see how the target fits into its overall strategy and to determine the impact of the given acquisition on the earnings, valuation, and taxes of the consolidated entities. If the consolidator, the buyer in a roll-up strategy, is public or close to an initial public offering, it must also consider the reaction of Wall Street, the business media, and the investment bankers to each transaction. Some roll-up companies are the result of certain private equity or venture capital firms picking target industries, hiring management teams to manage the consolidation process, and then financing the deals with their own capital resources. The well-managed roll-up companies have a specific strategic focus and rigid criteria for evaluating deals and are not just haphazardly accumulating companies to build an asset base or a revenue stream through consolidation. These better-managed companies are constantly searching for cross-marketing opportunities and operating efficiencies by and among their operating divisions, as well as ancillary yet related products and services that can be added to the menu. From the seller's perspective, if you are approached by a consolidator who is offering you primarily its own securities in order to join the team, be sure to realize that most of your upside in the deal is tied to the buyer's ability to execute its business and consolidation plan successfully. Make sure that you understand and agree with the buyer's strategy and vision, and that you are clear as to your role on a post-closing basis. Selling to your staff ESOPs as an acquisition exit strategy for sellers. An employee stock ownership plan, ESOP, is an alternative available to sellers for disposing of their business that offers certain tax advantages to both seller and lender. There is a wide range of small and middle market companies that cannot find a suitable buyer or that choose to sell the company to their employees and therefore create an ESOP to buy all or substantially all of the company using deferred compensation. There are two general categories of ESOPs. 1. Leveraged ESOP. This type of ESOP uses borrowed funds, either directly from the company or from a third-party lender based on the company's guarantee with the securities of the employer as collateral to acquire the employer's securities. The loan will be repaid by the ESOP from employer and employee contributions, as well as any dividends that may be paid on the employer's securities. 2. Non-leveraged ESOP. This type of ESOP involves a stock bonus plan, or a contribution stock bonus plan with a money purchase pension plan that purchases the employer's securities using funds from the employer that would have been paid as some other form of compensation that were not provided by a third-party lender. General legal considerations in structuring an ESOP. ESOPs, like all types of deferred compensation plans, must meet certain requirements set forth by the IRS as summarized here. Failure to meet these requirements will result in the contributions by the sponsoring employer not being tax deductible. To ensure that you are in compliance with IRS regulations, when creating your ESOP, you must establish a trust in order to make contributions. The trust must be for the exclusive benefit of the participants and their beneficiaries. Not discriminate in favor of officers, major shareholders, or highly compensated employees, particularly regarding the allocation of assets and income distribution. A good rule of thumb is that at least 70% of all non-highly compensated employees must be covered by the plan. Benefit no fewer than the lesser of 1, 50 employees, or 2, 40% or more of the employees of the plan sponsor. Invest primarily in the securities of the sponsoring employer. Although there are no strict guidelines, it is assumed that at least 50 to 60% of the ESOP portfolio will consist of the employer's securities at any given time. Vest in compliance with one of the minimum vesting schedules set forth by the IRS. The plan must adopt either 1. 5-year cliff vesting, the employee is vested after 5 years of service, or 2. 7-year scheduled vesting, 20% is fully vested after 3 years, increasing by 20% per year until 100% vesting is reached after 7 years. Establish voting requirements that conform to those set forth by the IRS. Under the Internal Revenue Code, voting rights may be vested in the trust's fiduciary, except under certain circumstances where rights must be passed through to the plan's participants. Generally, passing through becomes an issue when the vote will involve mergers, consolidations, reorganizations, recapitalizations, liquidations, major asset sales, and the like. Voting rights in toto may be passed through to employees, however, at the discretion of the employer in structuring the plan. Failure to fully pass through these rights may raise personnel and productivity problems. If the employees do not feel like true owners and as a result are cynical about the ESOP, thereby defeating a major incentive for adopting the ESOP. Comply with IRS rules regarding the distribution of ESOP benefits and assets. The plan must provide for a prompt, within 1 year, distribution of benefits to the participants following retirement, disability, or death. The nature and specific timing of the distribution will depend in part on the cause for the employee's separation from service with the company, as well as whether the sponsoring employer is closely held as opposed to publicly traded. Base the employer's contributions on a specific percentage of payroll, such as a money purchase pension plan, or on some other formula, such as a percentage of profits, as is the case with some profit-sharing plans. This form provides for maximum flexibility in that contributions are at the complete discretion of the employer. Each year, the employer simply makes a determination of the appropriate amount of contribution. It should be noted that the plan provides for a minimum contribution sufficient to permit the plan to pay any principal and interest due with respect to a loan used to acquire the employer's securities. The employer's contribution may be made in cash or other property, including the employer's securities. In the event that the employer contributes its own securities, it may obtain a so-called cashless deduction. The employer is entitled to deduct the fair market value of the securities so contributed, and the contribution involves no cash outlay by the employer. Provide adequate consideration in connection with the purchase of the employer's stock in an ESOP. This requires that some method for valuation of the shares must be available. For publicly traded companies, this is generally not a problem, since the prevailing market price is a sufficient indication of value. For privately held companies, however, value must be determined by the fiduciaries of the plan acting in good faith. This will generally require an independent appraisal by a qualified third-party appraisal firm, initially upon the establishment of the ESOP and at least annually thereafter. The cost and impact of such an appraisal on a closely held company should be considered before adopting an ESOP plan. Key legal documents in the establishment of an ESOP. A wide variety of legal documents must be prepared in connection with the organization and implementation of an ESOP by a seller. These documents must be prepared by counsel, however, only after input has been received from all key members of the company's ESOP team, for example, financial and human resources staff, accountants, investment bankers, commercial lenders, the designated trustee, the designated appraisal firm, and so on. The preliminary analysis that should be conducted prior to the preparation of the documents should include the impact on dilution, ownership, control, and earnings of the company, the type of securities to be issued, common versus preferred, the tax deductibility of contributions and related tax issues, registration of the securities where required under federal and state securities laws, employee motivation and productivity improvement analysis, current and future capital requirements and growth plans for the company, interplay of the ESOP with other current or planned employee benefit plans within the company, the timetable for planning, organization, and implementation of the ESOP. ESOP documentation. Once these and other factors have been considered and strategic decisions have been made, counsel may be instructed to prepare the necessary documentation. In a leverage ESOP, the documents may include 1. The ESOP plan, 2. The ESOP trust agreement, which may be combined with the plan, 3. ESOP loan documentation, such as the loan agreement or note guarantee. The initial set of documents may be from the commercial lender to the sponsoring employer, with a mirror image loan being made by the employer to the ESOP. 4. The ESOP stock purchase agreement, where stock is purchased from the employer or its principal shareholders. 5. Corporate charter amendments and related board resolutions. And 6. Legal opinion and valuation reports. The primary issues to be addressed by each of these documents are as follows. The ESOP plan, where the trust agreement is self-contained. 1. Designation of a name for the ESOP. 2. Definition of key terms, participant, year of service, trustee, and so on. 3. Eligibility to participate, standards and requirements. 4. Contributions by employer, designated amount or formula, discretionary. 5. Investment of trust assets, primarily in employer securities, along with plans for diversification of the portfolio, purchase price for the stock, rules for borrowing by the ESOP, and so on. 6. Procedures for release of the shares from encumbrances, formula as the ESOP obligations are paid down. 7. Voting rights, rights vested in trustee, special matters triggering employee voting rights. 8. Duties of the trustee or trustees, accounting, administrative, appraisal, asset management, record keeping, voting obligations, preparation of annual reports, allocation and distribution of dividends, and so on. 9. Removal of trustee or trustees. 10. Effect of participants' retirement, disability, death, and severance of employment. 11. Terms of the put option for closely held companies. 12. Rights of first refusal upon transfer. 13. Vesting schedules. ESOP stock purchase agreement. 1. Appropriate recitals. 2. Purchase terms for the securities. 3. Conditions to closing. 4. Representations and warranties of the seller. 5. Representations and warranties of the buyer. 6. obligations prior to and following the closing, 7, termination, 8, opinion of counsel, 9, exhibits, attachments, and schedules. Structuring the offer to meet the needs of both parties in an ESOP transaction. Seller's needs. 1. Price. 2. Form of consideration, cash, stock, notes, and so on. 3. Continuing employment or involvement. 4. Important qualitative concerns. 5. Hidden agenda. Buyer's needs. 1. Control. 2. Return on investment. 3. Minimal cash equity. 4. Retention of key managers. 5. Structured to meet lenders' needs. Tools to bridge the gap. 1. Cash is king. Try to limit net worth. 2. Unsecured subordinated long-term notes with low fixed interest rates. 3. Employment and consulting contracts. 4. Non-compete agreement. 5. Earnouts. Chapter 9. Valuation and pricing of the seller's company. Price is the paramount issue in a merger and acquisition transaction. Beyond anything else, it determines the amount of value that is transferred to the seller in exchange for ownership of the business that is for sale. It is the number one concern for both buyers and sellers, and it ultimately determines whether or not a transaction can be consummated. It is also always critical to distinguish between price and terms. The price could be very favorable to a seller, but be crippled by alternative terms that make the transaction unpalatable, costly, and risky. There are several established and traditional valuation methods used to estimate the price range within which a business will be sold. The actual price, however, is ultimately determined by what companies are willing to pay, which will be as much a function of market conditions as it is of economic formulas. Although a formal valuation of the seller's business is a vital component of the buyer's analysis of the proposed transaction, it is important to realize that valuation is not an exact science, nor will valuation alone typically drive the terms and pricing of the transaction. There are numerous acceptable valuation methods, and in most situations, each will yield a different result. Unfortunately, no method will answer the question, how much is the business actually worth? That question can be answered only through the receipt and negotiation of term sheets. The reality is that the market determines the price, and valuation, while an important exercise, is only indicative of what the market has paid for similar companies in the past. That said, there is clearly utility in the exercise of valuation because both buyers and sellers use these tools to gain insight into whether their perception of value is likely to intersect the other party's perception of value. In late 2017, at the time this manuscript went to print, valuations in a variety of industries had reached alarming highs. Was this the new normal? Or were we on the cusp of another market bubble? Many felt that traditional EBITDA-based valuation methodologies had become extinct and failed to recognize other variables and metrics that drive shareholder value, while skeptics felt strongly that financial performance still trumped other intangibles. Should Apple have paid over $3 billion for Beats? Should Microsoft have paid over $25 billion for LinkedIn? Should Facebook have paid $1 billion for Instagram? Even non-public, non-M&A-driven valuations seemed frothy. In the spring of 2017, ride-hailing company Lyft Incorporated, a clear number two in the market compared to Uber, fetched a recent financing round that valued it at $7.5 billion and included some pretty smart investors, including Alibaba, General Motors, and Andreessen Horowitz, notwithstanding operating losses. Note that market leader Uber had been valued at $70 billion in its most recent round of capital raising. Where the right valuation should be in these times of uncertainty is hotly debated among pundits, experts, investment bankers, and buyers and sellers. Low interest rates give way to elevated profit margin. The Trump administration's promises of tax cuts and regulatory reform may further drive market valuations if they come to fruition. But beyond the Beltway, new metrics are being recognized and reinforced that will change how companies are valued in the context of M&A or otherwise as we enter the age of robotics, AI, big data, brand loyalty, customer experience, autonomous vehicles, drones, and other technological phenomena that will directly and indirectly influence valuation in the decades ahead of us. The stunning value of digital companies. An incredible $2.8 trillion. This is the market capitalization of five of the six largest companies in the United States: Amazon, Apple, Alphabet, Google, Facebook, and Microsoft. Three of them are younger than 25, two of them barely 45 years old, and all are located on the U.S. West Coast. To put that into context, the combined market value of the 30 companies listed in Germany's DAX 30 is a mere $1.1 trillion, and the most valuable company there, SAP, with $100 billion value, turned 45 this year. Almost every other significant player in the German market was founded 100 or more years ago. As of late 2017, Apple had readied a market capitalization of more than $900 billion, making it the first global company to be just a few steps away from a $1 trillion valuation. And another digital company is rising fast in valuation. Tesla. Yes, Tesla is a digital company, not so much a car company, surpassed GM and Ford recently in market capitalization, and now is approaching the market cap of BMW, the top German car company. The future of EBITDA. We often talk about EBITDA, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, multiples, as the key price determiner. EBITDA is a metric or formula that essentially values a company based on its historical and likely future cash flow. When the markets are robust, you hear stories of companies in the hottest industries commanding EBITDA multiples of 8, 10, and even 12 times their earnings. In a softer market and in weaker industries, buyers may be lucky to get 1.5 or 2 times their earnings. In other industries, such as technology, biotech, and software, the EBITDA multiple may not be the best formula for determining a company's true value, and the multiplier may be based on gross sales, number of customers, contracts, or some other key economic variable. To sell a company at the higher end of the EBITDA multiple range prevailing in the market, you will need to demonstrate to the buyer a series of value drivers that can substantiate and support a higher price. These value drivers vary from company to company, but they can generally include a strong management team that will commit to staying in place after the closing, a loyal customer base, dedicated and profitable distribution channels, a culture of innovation and creativity with a robust new product or service pipeline, a deep inventory of protectable intellectual property, a global market presence, demand trends that appear strong in the future, and an overall competitive advantage that appears to be sustainable over the medium to long term. Conversely, it is critical to conduct an analysis of any possible value leakage and to fill those holes well before any potential buyers conduct their strategic due diligence. Failure to maximize value and take corrective pre-transactional action on problems that are likely to be identified by a buyer and that will influence price and terms could not only cost you millions of dollars in an EBITDA calculation, but also subject you to legal action for failure to meet your fiduciary obligations toward the minority shareholders of your company. Another mistake that is often made is the failure to harvest or recognize key intangible assets that will be valuable to a buyer after closing. The variables driving a leakage in value can include gaps in the management team, tax and regulatory problems, pending litigation, disgruntled channel and strategic partners, accounting and financial statement issues, hasty due diligence preparation, and a seller's willingness to accept tougher-than-market deal terms because it is perceived to be desperate or overanxious to sell the company. The prevalence of value leakage is more common than you might think. The idea that sellers would purposely or negligently drop critical strategic balls that would otherwise have fetched them millions more in purchase price seems counterintuitive, but in a full 2007 KPMG survey of corporate sellers and private equity fund managers, nearly 50% said that they failed to maximize value in their latest sale or portfolio divestiture, and, even more alarmingly, two-thirds of the respondents said that they were not likely to correct the practices that led to the acknowledged undervaluation over the next 5 years. To determine the value of a company, several key questions must be addressed. To whom is the asset valuable? In what context is the asset worth paying for? Before we get into the specifics of how businesses are valued, it is important to understand how prices are set in the real world. A quick introduction to pricing. The key question in pricing is, how do I, the seller, extract as much value from the buyer as possible? The obvious answer is, get as much as the business is worth to the buyer. Although this would certainly maximize the price paid, there are certain real-world constraints that prevent this from happening. First, people generally do not advertise how much something is worth to them. A man who is dying of thirst will value a glass of water far more than someone who has just drunk a glass of water. However, unless the potential water customers are willing to identify their situation, the water vendor may be able to charge only a single price. Similarly, just as a computer is worthless to someone who does not have electricity, worth a small amount to a 3-year-old child, and potentially worth millions to a technology entrepreneur, it is impossible to charge a single price and capture all of the value provided to each of the 3 potential computer customers. In the real world, this problem is addressed through versioning, where vendors force customers to identify the segment in which they belong by providing different options that appeal to each segment differently. For the child, a basic kid's computer is all that is necessary. The technology entrepreneur, on the other hand, will probably prefer a more high-end computer and will pay a substantially different price as a result. Similarly, a Tiffany's diamond, while often the same quality as diamonds sold at other retail locations, commands a 30 to 50% premium because the Tiffany's brand is attached. There are several key lessons from the world of pricing. Each potential buyer will value a business differently. Getting the buyer to identify itself or its intentions helps determine what good should be offered and how that good will be valued. Cost is often not relevant in determining market value. That is, the price of bottled water is not at all related to the cost of the water, which is ostensibly free. A single set price will exclude certain buyers from bidding and will not ensure that the maximum price is paid. An auction pricing format is generally believed to be the best way for a seller to maximize the price paid by the buyer. There are several different auction formats, each with generally the same principles. 1. A competitive process ensures that the price offered is near the maximum price that any individual buyer is willing to pay. 2. The winner pays more than all the other bidders are willing to pay. And 3. The winner generally pays just a little bit more than what the second highest bidder was willing to pay. When this format is applied to businesses, there are several key differences. First, no business buyer likes to participate in an auction, as these buyers understand the principle and the expected outcome, And second, it is generally very difficult to ensure that each potential bidder adheres to the same process and schedule as the other bidders. Nevertheless, the concept of an auction is a valuable tool for a seller and should be simulated as much as is reasonably possible during a sales process. Finally, an auction, while great for maximizing the price that is actually paid, still does not help inform the buyer or seller of what the likely outcome of the auction process will be. For that, we turn